What really gets my dick hard is...
Hey, this is Michael Alago from Who the F Is That Guy documentary, and you're listening to Metal Up Your Podcast.
Welcome to the Metal Up Podcast. I'm Ethan Luck.
And I'm Clint Wells.
And this is episode number 67, and this is a special treat episode for us and you listeners. We got another guest. We got Mr. Jim Florentine, known for That Metal Show, Crank Yankers, all sorts of stuff. He has a new book out, which we'll get into. He's an amazing dude. We had a great conversation with him, and we'll get into that shortly.
Yeah, it was really nice to meet and talk to Jim. Huge metal fan, huge Metallica fan, super funny cat, a lot of insight into the... We talk their discography, we talk about his work on That Metal Show. It's real cool. I'm excited to for everyone to hear that.
Oh, yeah.
Before we do that, we have the housekeeping stuff. We'll try to get through it real quick. We know you're all anxious to hear our conversation with Jim. If you don't know who we are, we're an All Metallica podcast. Ethan and I are professional touring musicians based in Nashville. Every week, despite our busy schedules, we make time to get together, talk about our favorite metal band, Slayer. No, Metallica, of course. So if you're just now jumping in, we really appreciate you listening. Take a minute and go to iTunes, leave us a review if you like it. We do a contest every month where we give out 5 gifts to listeners. We randomly draw the people who leave the iTunes review. Their name goes into a queue. We draw 5 names. For the month of March, we're actually doing the giveaway of our Cover Our World Blackened EP, which the only way you can get that is through Patreon, which we'll tell you about that in a minute. So we're giving away 10 free downloads of that. So all you got to do is leave the review, and we'll give you some shit for free. It's that simple.
So easy. So easy.
Speaking of patrons, I think we got some new ones this week.
Did we now?
I'm a poor co-host and have not pulled this up on my phone yet. But it'll only take a second if you
I know one patron that we got this week that's actually my next-door neighbor.
And really?
Yeah. So a quick little backstory. In East Nashville, where I live.
Is it Kim?
It's Kim. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So my next door neighbor, Kim. Yeah. She, the other day, I went out to say hi to her, and she was outside doing the yard work, and she had some earbuds in, and she's like, I'm actually listening to you right now. I'm like, what, my music? She's like, no, your Metallica podcast. I was like, no shit. So yeah. So my next door neighbor is a new listener and a patron.
Flattering, mostly. Maybe a little weird.
Not weird at all, unless Kim starts knocking on my back door. Like,
she's hey, like, I'm listening.
So on episode 46, you mentioned this, and she's actually going to come over and correct me on the Outlaw Torn, probably.
She's listening to you talk about boners, your neighbor.
Unfortunately. Sorry, Kim.
Well, we do want to say thanks to Kim for getting on the ride.
Heck,
our friend,
yeah.
Our friend Nicole Williams increased her pledge, which is always nice. And Brandon Horton, I think we mentioned him last week, but I think that was it. So
yeah.
All right, cool.
Thank you guys for your patronage.
Yeah, come hang out with us on all the socials. We're on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. We're now on Spotify, as we mentioned last week.
Yeah, you can find us on all the things.
We're on the YouTube. Good God. Just go find it.
Yeah, if there's something you use, we're probably on it, except for that new Vero one, which I got on for about 2 seconds, and I deleted it. I was like, why do I need it? Something else?
Mm. Good, what, nice yeah, story.
Whatever, thanks.
Nice story. Tell it to the Reader's Digest. The best way to get a hold of us, as always, is metalupyourpodcastshow@gmail.com. We read a handful of emails every week. We like giving a voice to the Metallica community. We love hearing from you. If you want to correct us about something, if you want to share your Metallica story, if you want to tell us what your top 10 is, whatever the case may be, send that email to metalupyourpodcastshow@gmail.com. Let's listen to some emails.
Let's do it. All right, our first email is from Brad. Hi. Thanks, Brad.
Hi, Brad.
Brad says, hi, just heard the first episode and wanted to say thanks for putting it together. I've been looking for a podcast like this for a while. I will listen some more to some more episodes and see how it goes. Well, I hope it goes well. Then I think about becoming a patron. On a side note, if I saw James, I'd thank him for getting me into literature. When I first heard For Whom the Bell Tolls, I went out and read the book. I had no idea Hemingway could be as epic as Metallica. I've been reading ever since. Cheers, Brad.
Yeah, that's cool, man.
It's very cool.
There were some literary cats.
Yeah, man.
If you really want to go down a real serious hole, go check out some H.P. Lovecraft. If you like Call of Cthulhu, thing that should
that's
not
Harry
be.
That's Harry Potter Lovecraft for all you laymen out there.
That's right. Thanks, Brad. Jason.
What a great name for a band, by the way. What's up? We're Harry Potter Lovecraft.
Good night, Dark Continent. Harry Potter, Lovecraft, out.
Expelliarmus to all of you.
Jason Williams says, good day, brothers. Greetings from Bendigo, Australia.
That's in New Jersey.
New Jersey, of course. Love the podcast. It's become one of the highlights of my week. An aspect I find particularly appealing about the podcast is you're just two chill dudes that are quite reasonable in your analysis and views of different topics. Being prepared to fuck up, agree to disagree, admit you're wrong, and not assume your views are the right ones. It's refreshing, to be honest. Thanks, dude. That's nice.
Yeah.
He says, the musicianship side of the podcast is a winner as well. Comments made about songwriting, recording, etc. are all interesting to me as I'm a guitarist. I've never really been a lyrics guy, apart from how they contribute to the melody, but listening to your podcast has opened my mind a little to lyrical structure and how they tell stories. As an extension of that, I've been writing song lyrics recently as a way to deal with a few life issues I've been going through, so be proud that your influence is helping people.
Wow, very cool.
My only question in relation to song lyrics is, in your opinion, what makes them good? I never really paid any real attention to my lifestyle determines my death style until you guys started poking fun at it. So as a criteria, what makes something good or bad? On a brighter note, my 2-year-old daughter loves Metallica. She claps and air drums to the songs. Moth in the Flame is her favorite, and she loves shouting, burn. Proud dad here. Keep up the good work, guys. You're doing great. P.S. You owe me approximately $1,000. All of your talk of vinyl records led me to purchase a record player and several records. PayPal is fine.
Well, sorry. I only use Venmo.
It's true. Once you get on that vinyl train, it's, you know,
it's hard to jump off.
It's that shit gets expensive, and
my vinyl
up.
Train just goes really slow on the tracks now. I used to be hauling ass down those rails.
I've slowed down quite a bit as well.
Yeah.
Well,
now I have a mortgage and bills.
Yeah, wife, kid, all that stuff.
I've got all the kids.
A Pornhub.com subscription. It's hard to make room for the vinyl. So he asks, "What is it that makes lyrics good?" Well, it's obviously subjective. I think he knows that. He's asking in our opinion. It really depends on what the goal of the song is. I mean, Red Hot Chili Peppers have some of the most insane lyrics in the world, but they're kind of funny and they fit phonetically in the song.
They fit for that band and their style and their
image. It kind of depends on what the intention of the song is. If it's a Dylan-esque kind of political tirade, you know, or a Springsteen thing, the lyric matters a bit more.
Yeah, and a lot of those guys are trying to tell a story. You know, they're storytellers at heart. And I kind of tend to gravitate more towards lyrics like that, lyrics that paint an image in my head of what they're talking about. And that applies to Metallica songs too, you know?
And I think you nailed it. As a songwriter, we deal with this a lot of like, most songs are about the girl won't have sex with me, or I like the guy and he doesn't like me back. That's what most songs are. Now, just saying that plainly isn't going to cut it. You know, you want to show, not tell, right?
Why won't she have sex with me?
She doesn't like me and I'm sad.
Is it because I got hair in weird places?
So, yeah, it's like taking these basic elements of human experience and making them relatable, but also dressing them up in some interesting poetry, interesting language. I think James Hetfield is wonderful at that. And I think, in my personal opinion, it won't surprise many of you, I think the Load Reload era is the most interesting part because he took what was great about his observational skills, whether he's writing about heroin addiction and Master of Puppets, or he's telling the story like For Whom the Bell Tolls or Creeping Death, stories that he'd read. Load and Reload is really where he starts getting super personal and digging in. So when you get lyrics like Low Man's Lyric, Mama Said, Hero of the Day, Bleeding Me, Outlaw Torn, Fixer. That shit goes real deep. And he was able to write it in a way that was poetic and interesting and artistic, but you also get an insight into who he is. So to me, that would be some of the criteria.
Yeah, for sure. And Jason, in closing, I would say, you know, keep writing lyrics and
keep it up, dude.
And you know, you mentioned that you're writing them because you're dealing with some things in your life. And that's what the root of most lyrics are, is personal experience and
100%.
The things that surround you. You know, you can sit down and write something fictional from maybe someone else's point of view. And that's fun too. But start with your personal life, what you've experienced, reflect on your life. And you can always draw inspiration from that kind of stuff.
And you got to keep doing it too. I mean, I call it writing through. Like you got to write through. I mean, dude, your first 20 lyrics are probably not going to be barn burners because you're learning what your voice is. You're learning how to do it. You know, Jim actually did a really fascinating thing where he found all of his like jokes from his first few years of stand-up. He like found them in a notebook and he read them like on a comedy record and put it out.
Oh, wow.
Because he said he couldn't believe how bad they were.
Yeah.
And you got to go through it, man.
I mean, that's like you and I putting out like our earliest demos when we were like teenagers.
Oh, my God.
I wouldn't do that.
Oh, my God.
Jim has he's a bigger man than we are.
So anyway, keep it up, Jason. That's cool, dude.
Thanks,
good,
Jason.
Good luck.
All right, next email is from Mike Fell. My wife, her sister, and husband and I would watch the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest on every July 4th every year, disgusted and confused. 4 years ago, we decided to go to Coney Island for the 4th and watch it in person. It's more ridiculous there somehow when you're standing in the street with a beer before noon watching people eat a ton of hot dogs. One guy even dipped his buns in like a red Kool-Aid instead of water, making it somehow 10 times grosser.
Yeesh.
Delicious. As long as they're veggie dogs. they hold regional qualifiers that we considered entering as a joke, but haven't yet. I think I'm officially a fan of the event now. I think if you enter as a joke, you'd probably get destroyed. Those dudes take it
seriously.
They do.
It's no joke.
The guy's like, you know, the Kool-Aid is coming over like, hey, motherfucker, get off our turf.
Yeah, so do you use Crystal Light or are you using red Kool-Aid? Yeah. What's your strategy?
Bro, are you even a dogger?
Do you even wet hot dog?
Mike continues to say, Bread Fan was the first song I ever heard Metallica play live. Opened with it in Milwaukee in 98 on the poor retouring me. It's killer and always excited to hear that song. Clint, great work on the Lunar Satan track. I want to know what the visual aesthetic will be for the upcoming stadium tour, which has to follow. At a minimum, I want to see you open for Tool when they get their next record, maybe finally someday finished and go on the road.
Well, thank you. The reaction to the new Lunar Satan track was pretty positive.
Yeah.
I'm glad everyone is liking that shit. It's super funny. It's super fun. For those of you who don't know, it is a it's a satanic metal project that I started set in space where Satan was frozen by ancient Christians and they sent him out to around Pluto. In current times, satanic Luciferian astronauts have found his frozen body and through various spells and incantations thawed him out. The record is the story of Satan's revenge on ancient Christianity and the universe in general.
Couldn't they have just, like, if they made it that far out to find his frozen body, couldn't they have just, like, moved him closer to the sun to thaw him out?
We'll get into how they thawed him out. Okay. There will be a whole song about it. Okay. The last tune
you thawed him out. You thawed him out.
The last song, of course, being Set the Witch on Fire. Again, now the visual aesthetic for the tour... I haven't really thought about that. It'll involve demons and warlocks. Maybe it'll just be a big Satan's butt, and I'll, like Bon Jovi in the 80s, I'll just come right out of it into the center stage, single spotlight on me.
And you're
but that's cool. I'm glad you dig it. Thanks, Mike. Chris Overholt says, hey, Clint and Ethan, my name's Chris, and I hail from Chicago. That's an interesting... I hail from Chicago. I found your podcast by doing a Google search for Metallica podcast, and you guys were the first result. I figured it must be the best of the podcast dedicated to the mighty Metallica. I started with the Wayne Summers interview, and I got to tell you, what an episode to jump into the fire. I'm not listening to your podcast in order, browsing the catalog and picking the episodes based on which subjects interest me the most. My favorites so far have been Behind the Fire with our friend Matt Thomas, Cunning Stunts, and both parts of Some Kind of Monster. I started listening to Metallica with the Black Album and have seen them three times. Unlike most of your listeners, I like Load and Reload. He says, I had a theory about a certain scene in Some Kind of Monster. When Lars and Dave are talking and Dave says that someone important isn't there, most people assume he's referring to James Hetfield because James was in rehab.
Not there.
He says, do you think he may be referring to Cliff? Just my personal take on that part. Maybe it's going too deep. Thanks for doing what you do, and I look forward to more podcasts. Cheers and rock on. That is an interesting theory.
It's an interesting theory. I mean, my gut would say that he's still referring to James, because I think it goes without saying that, yes, Cliff is not there and hasn't been there for a long time, you know, and really for back when, you know, they booted Mustaine out of the band, I mean, it was James and Lars really doing the dirty work.
Yeah, you know, as much as Cliff's in many ways... towered above James and Lars, especially James. They really looked up to Cliff.
Oh, yeah.
That was more musical, I think. I don't think he was a very confrontational person.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And so I think when it came time to get the axe, he probably put his vote in. He probably said, yeah, this Dave Mustaine cat's a drunk mess. I'm all about getting him out.
Hey, you guess fire him. I'm going to go to the bar.
I'm going to go eat a taco. I'm going to go eat some Mexican food. Yeah. Yeah, I think he was talking about James.
Yeah. I think so. It's an interesting thought, though. I mean, had he been referring to Cliff, you know, see, I think if he was actually referring to Cliff, I think maybe the talk would have gotten a lot deeper.
Well, wouldn't it be weird if if Lars had been like, yeah, no, James isn't here. And he's like, oh, I'm not talking about James. I don't care if James is here.
Yeah,
I'm talking about Cliff. It's like, oh, Cliff. You don't want to talk to James about your unceremonious firing 20 years ago?
What if he's talking about Rahm McGovney?
That's what he's talking. Oh, he's talking about Lloyd Grant.
Lloyd Grant. That's what it was.
Very important person's not here. My little Danish friend. We used to smoke hash from a hole in the ground.
Yeah. Again, good, interesting theory. Something fun to think about. But yeah, I'm pretty sure he's... fairly certain he's referring to James.
And it's that simple, folks. If you want to have your thing read on the show, send us an email at metalupyourpodcastshow@gmail.com. Let's get the fuck out of here.
Let's do it. Hey, this is Ethan and Clint from Metal Up Your Podcast, and we want to talk to you about something we love called Patreon.
That's right. Patreon is a way for fans of the show to give back to the show, to donate money that helps us in quality and content. And not only that, but we've actually come up with all sorts of fun incentives to give back to you for supporting the show.
Exactly. For instance, if you donate $5 or more, you get access to Cover Our World Blackened, which is the official Metal Up Your Podcast Metallica cover EP.
That's right, and that's the only way to get it. In addition to the EP, we also give you priority email access, meaning we'll read your email first on the show. We give you early access to Patreon-exclusive merchandise, Patreon-exclusive giveaways, and any other side projects that Ethan and I might be involved in.
There's all sorts of things you can look at on there and you can donate to. Go check it out, patreon.com/metalupyourpodcast. How do you spell that, Clint?
patreon.com/metalupyourpodcast. And if you really think about it, $5 a month for an entire year, that's really just like a cup of coffee a month. So go check it out. Thanks, everyone. Peace.
Adios.
All right. Again, for those of you who don't know, Jim Florentine, super cool dude. He is a stand-up comedian, an actor, author, and TV personality. His new book is called Everybody's Awful Except You. You can get it on his website, jimflorentine.com. You've heard of him, Crank Anchors, Terrorizing Telemarketers, various stand-up specials.
That Metal Show, have you heard of that?
That Metal Show, have you heard of course. Of so come on a journey with us and Jim Florentine.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's safe to say we, again, can't thank Jim enough for his time. So we hope you enjoy this as much as we did talking to him.
Let's get into it. All right, we're here with our new friend Jim Florentine, stand-up comedian, actor, author, TV personality. He's got a bitchin' podcast. He's got a new book called Everybody is Awful Except You that you can get at his website, jimflorentine.com, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Jim, thanks for being on the show, dude.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man. Absolutely.
Heck yeah, man. Well, you know, I think it goes without saying that, you know, we've been big fans of yours for a long time. You know, everything from, you know, Crank Anchors to That Metal Show to your current podcast, all that stuff. You've obviously been beyond busy for a number of years, and you know, we know you're a busy guy, so yeah, this is a treat for us and our listeners that you'd take time out of your day to talk to us about your career and a little Metallica.
No problem. But you don't understand my history of Metallica. I've been defending these guys for years like I'm in the band.
We do the same thing.
I almost lost a friend and had a fist fight over the Saint Anger album.
Well, so are you on the what side do you take on Saint Anger? Since we're going to start here,
I give on a scale of 1 to 10, I give it like a 7, maybe a 7.5.
Wow,
that's that's pretty generous compared to you know the general public.
So,
I think.
Yeah, so if Puppets is a 10, you give Saint Anger a 7. Where does
I know when you look at it that way. Yeah, I mean maybe not, but those numbers are big. Look. All right, who's the hottest girl in the world right now? Let's just
my
say
mom,
Scarlett
easily.
Johansson.
Easily my Who? Mom. My mom, probably. Is that weird?
All right, you might. Let's say Scarlett Johansson is a 10.
I agree with that.
Then, you know, you see another girl go, ah, it's a 7. You're like, she's only 3 away from Scarlett. Okay, yeah.
Well, my...
So, yeah, it's a 7. 7.25.
I've always felt like taking on its own terms and, like, with the context of what the band was going through, and in an isolated way, it's a really fascinating record and maybe even powerful in a lot of ways. But yeah, stacking it up against Lightning and Puppets and Justice, it gets tough.
It is tough, yeah.
But we're the same way. I mean, you know, they're our favorite fucking band. So, I mean, where do you stand on Lulu? Do you still defend them on that too?
Lulu, the way I looked at it is like, look, they wanted to do a little side project in between albums. to keep them busy and their little creative, little artsy thing. Let them go do it, because my whole theory on that was, they're not coming out. At that time, they weren't going to come out with Lou Reed and do five songs off that record when you saw them live. So I don't care.
Right, exactly. And those guys being such, you know, big Velvet Underground Lou Reed fans, you know, I think James has even said, like, you can't say no to Lou Reed.
Yep, yeah, that, true. And it's like, yeah, I mean, they weren't going to go on tour and do, you know, half the Lulu record and then half the old stuff. And you're like, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I wasn't worried about that.
Yeah.
So you got your start. You were doing the Terrorizing Telemarketers, and Howard Stern got a hold of it and started playing it on a show. And what did that sort of break through things for you? Was that sort of a defining point in your career?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, I was doing stand-up probably like around 8 or 9 years at that point. You know, just, you know, playing little plates and stuff like that. But once he started playing my telemarketer calls on the radio, he had me, you know, I got this exposure, and then he had me in, and I sat in on the show, and then I started plugging all my comedy shows, and then I got pretty much, you know, everything in my career from that show, because so many people listened to it back in the day. I mean, they still do, but I'm just saying, like, back in the day when he was on regular radio, he probably had like 20 million people listening a day.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a bad break at all, especially, you know, if you're doing, you know, stand-up maybe somewhat locally, somewhat regionally, doing these, you know, crank calls to telemarketers. It's like anyone's dream doing anything creative to have that platform to be able to get your stuff out there. So, I mean, what a way to start.
Were you a Stern fan?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I listen to him every day. I used to work construction, and I when he was on, if it wasn't a commercial break, you weren't allowed to use any power tools. Because we'd have the radio cranking, like, on the roof or whatever we were. And I'm like, no, and not because the commercial breaks were like 10 minutes. They go, that's when you could use a saw.
Yeah.
I need to hear the show.
So the building took, like, 6 years to create.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Did you know he was going to be playing your stuff, or did you kind of hear it while you were working
construction? Oh, no, I just dropped it off. Me and Don Jameson knew Gary Delabate, the producer, and we just went to his office one day and we dropped off the CD. He goes, all right. He goes, if it's funny, he'll play it. I don't know. You know, I can't guarantee you. I'm like, all right. And meanwhile, there was a stack of, like, you know, 300 other CDs on his desk. I'm
right.
Like, he's not playing this. But, he's, you know, it was nice of him to say that. But, you know, what else are you going to say? You know. And then the next morning, he started playing it.
Yeah, really? The next morning? I mean, that's like dropping off your demo to a major label at that point in Stern's career.
That's a good point. That's a really good point. Because I had, like, you know, I would work at night, so sometimes I'd catch the last part of the show when I woke up, or, you know, so I wasn't up at like 6 a.m. when I started doing stand-up listening to Stern, or I'd record the shows, and my friend would record them for me, whatever. So I had no idea. I didn't think, let me get up at 6 a.m. when he goes on the air and see if he plays my stuff. I'm like, he's not going to play, and if he does, it's definitely not going to be tomorrow. And then when I woke up at like 9:30, I had all these voice messages like, dude, turn the show on, he's playing your stuff.
Wow.
And do you still keep up with those cats? I know you're friends with Richard Christie, right?
Yeah, yeah. I just did the Stern wrap-up show a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, no shit.
And I know all those guys.
Awesome.
Yeah, I know all those guys out there. They're really cool.
Nice. I've been kind of a big Stern fan since the E days, the E Entertainment days. So that's cool, man. That's very cool. And so that sort of...
I was in studio that famous day when Gary Busey and him started, like, wrestling.
Oh, really?
Damn.
Yeah, I was in that day.
And that was real, right? That was real?
I guess, you know, it's funny because when they went back on the air, Howard's like, Jim, thanks for jumping in and help me out. And I go, I didn't know. I thought it was a bit. Like, I thought you guys were just messing around. And then it kind of looked like it kind of got serious. But I wasn't going to jump in, like, my third day ever on the show
right. And
ruin a bit. You know what I mean? Like, if it was, I wasn't sure what was going on.
And that's the thing about the Stern universe is, like, it's kind of all shtick, or, like, you don't really know. That's sort of what's so great about the show, you know? You don't know what's a bit or not, you know? So that sort of led you to Adam Carolla and Jimmy Kimmel and doing Crank Anchors, right?
Yeah. Yeah, they heard my calls on the Stern show, and you know, they're like, hey, we wanted this guy on the show, whoever he is. And, you know, they tracked me down, and, you know, and I got the gig on Crank Anchors, which was amazing. That was a whole other, you know, big boost for my career.
Yeah, and that was such a cool, innovative show. I mean, obviously, you know, there had been, you know, prank call things in the past with, you know, Jerky Boys and whatever, but, you know, to have, you know, have a visual to prank calls with puppets was, I mean, I remember watching that like crazy, thinking this is such an innovative, cool way to present crank calls to people by, you know, personifying these voices and stuff like that, you know, with you doing special ed and stuff. And it was, I mean, yeah, me and all my friends would sit down and watch that show. It was a fucking riot.
What was it like being at Comedy Central? Was that a good place to be to do comedy? I mean, what was it like?
Yeah, I mean, we just would do the calls in like a recording studio.
Okay.
And just record them, and then they would, sets at them and do all the puppets and all that stuff. So I wasn't really there, but, you know, I did a bunch of stuff for Comedy Central. No, it was great because that's when people were really watching Comedy Central.
Right.
It wasn't so, political, and all that stuff. So people just, it wasn't a lot of options for comedy. So it was a big time for Comedy Central at that time.
Yeah, they definitely got away with a lot more back then when you guys were doing Crank Anchors.
Well, yeah, people weren't as sensitive, absolutely, I think we were on at the right time before everybody, became offended by everything.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about that. Ethan and I are both big fans of comedy, and it seems like in sort of the current Me Too movement, the sort of current snowflake culture that we find ourselves in, has that changed anything for you in comedy? I mean, it seems to me like we need comedians more now than ever, but people are scared to say shit now, almost. Not comedians necessarily, but the culture just feels a lot different, right?
Well, it's all the media just building this up, just basically trying to tell us, what we need to say and all this other stuff. And, they pull one little thing out of a guy's, saying the word fag, and then they go, look at this clip, look at this person calling people a fag,
right,
like some gay guy walking out, some drunk guy, like that has been going on forever. You know what I mean? It's just like, so they pull it out, go, oh my God, you can't say this, you can't do that. Everybody's pretty much living their lives. People come to the comedy clubs, they're still laughing at inappropriate material. Nobody's getting offended. There's not more people walking out because a guy's doing a joke about, a girl, or a misogynist joke, or any of that stuff, or saying words. So it's really just the media trying to, force feed, what you can do and what you can't. That's one good thing about Trump. At least he called out the media, how, they're so biased, and they just, whatever their agenda is, instead of just reporting the news.
Right.
And that's what's true. It's like, okay, you need to say transphobic and trans, you can't say this and you can't say, it's like, okay, so why? So you made that decision? So now everybody has to, if everyone doesn't start doing it within a week, then we're ignorant and racist and whatever it is.
Right.
But I think the comedy clubs people actually come out to just, and they don't, they're so sick of just being bombarded with all that bullshit. That they're telling us what to do, that they're actually enjoying. Nobody, the comedy clubs of Florida, comedy has never been bigger, in the last couple of years. There's seven or eight comics that are selling out arenas. So people are coming to comedy clubs going, I want to have a few laughs. I don't want to be so, worry about what I have to, what I can laugh at. Whenever I'm at my job or at a school or PTA, I know I have to be PC. So let me go to a comedy club and laugh my ass off.
Well, I mean, and for a lot of people, like me and Clint included, a lot of times going to a comedy show or watching a comedy special on TV or DVD or whatever is a great escape from reality and from the media and the news and all the bullshit that surrounds our daily lives 23 hours a day.
Yeah.
That's why
comics are always supposed to push boundaries.
Absolutely.
That's the great comics have always done that. Lenny Bruce, Richard Pryor,
George Carlin.
You push boundaries.
Well, yeah.
And I feel like in a lot of ways, and when culture kind of is ramped up the way it is now, comedians sometimes are the only people who will sort of tell you the truth, And it's nice to laugh at it too, but or someone like Bill Hicks, I wonder often about what Bill Hicks would be, what kind of material he'd have now. Were you a Bill Hicks fan at all?
But yeah, definitely. No, it's true, because you don't get it. You get it from, you get the one side. You got both sides. You got, the conservatives and the liberals just spewing their views, and that's it. And you never get anything in the middle anymore. CNN used to be a place where you could just go and go, I just need, just give me the news, and you can't get that. So you really can't go anywhere for it.
Right,
anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe it is the comics.
Has the current culture, have you sort of, with your new material, have you sort of leaned into all this to sort of expose it for sort of the bullshit that it is?
Well, yeah, I'm working on that. But I don't talk politics on stage. I don't do Trump jokes. Just to me, it's like, my plumber does them on Facebook too. And so as a comic, you got to realize, all right, if your plumber is doing the same jokes as you or similar, then you got to move on. Like, you can't. That's considered hack, is what it's called. Remember the old joke with the of a cop? Oh, he's got a donut.
Right. Exactly.
Oh, look,
yeah.
The cop pulled out a donut. He was in Dunkin' Donuts. What a shot. That's when you knew, when everyone was making those jokes, the general public, you knew as a comic, you got to move on from that. So when someone's saying Trump's, the punchline to a Trump joke is it's a Polish joke. What did he do crazy at the end? What did he do that was so insane? Like, you know it's coming. Like a Polish, all right, a Polish guy walks in a bar, so you know at that end of that joke, that Polish guy is going to do something stupid. You know, not sure what, but that's the punchline.
So you're saying you're not going to be taking your plumber out on the road with you to open for your stand-up?
I mean, it should. I just go, look, you could do those Trump jokes because, you know, but, you know, there's a plus, you know, if I go on last on a show, especially on the road, I got three or four guys before me. What am I going to do? Okay, now let me do my Trump jokes. I know you heard theirs, but here's my angle.
Yeah, I swear they're better.
On why he's crazy or why he's nuts or whatever he's doing. You know what I mean?
So yeah, yeah.
I just stay away from it. To me, it's too easy. It's like, you know, everyone had I remember when I first started, like Lorena Bobbitt. Remember she cut John Wayne Bobbitt's dick off?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Every comic had a joke about that. And then at some point, the good comics go, all right, I'm not doing that anymore. The three guys before me had their version of the joke. And Pee Wee Herman, when he got caught masturbating in
right.
the movie theater, that was another one. Everyone had a joke like that, too.
Well, I'd imagine, too, in the climate we're in right now, with you avoiding Trump jokes, I'd imagine all it would do is drive you to be more creative and to come up with more original material to kind of be a step ahead of what everyone else is joking about.
Yeah, I mean, look, I always... My sets are usually just personal to me, and whatever he's doing, that's not personal to me. Like, I just talk about my life.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, I don't just do, like, monologue jokes. You know, when you got every guy in late night doing the same Trump jokes, you're like, well, did you hear that Trump joke? Well, who said it? You could pick from seven different guys. Oh, no, Seth Meyers said that one. Oh, he said that. Okay. It's the same joke over and over again. For the writers on those late night shows, they got the easiest job right now.
They really do.
I mean, they could sleep in. They could just, you know, just work an hour a day.
It's true, man.
Well, I do like your podcast. It does seem like your podcast is Comedy Metal Midgets. And you have kind of landed on an interesting thing where you do rants on Yelp reviews or weird Facebook posts about brunch. Or random rants. It's kind of a cool critique of all that culture, too. Like, I find that interesting. It seems very kind of unique to your voice. It's cool. I like your podcast a lot.
Well, I just tried to do something different with the podcast. Originally, I was going to interview, like, you know, comics or rock stars and stuff. But then I realized, you know, I don't have a lot of time for that, to schedule interviews and all that stuff. And then I just realized a lot of podcasts are like that, where there's other comics on the podcast and they're just talking comedy. And I just realized, I said, you know what, if I just do it myself and just do these different rants, and that's, you know, it just developed into that. So now I just pretty much keep it at that.
Well, I think you really have a true talent for it because, I mean, I, you know, having done this podcast for, you know, about 15 months now every Monday, it's challenging enough when you have a co-host to get together material and put out something that we feel is quality. So it does take a true talent, and this probably stems from your experience in stand-up and all the things you've done with the Comedy Central and this and that. To sit there for 1 hour straight and it's just you riffing.
Well, I mean, the people that listen to my podcast, I tell them, hey, send emails if you see anything out there that I won't like on social media, whatever, you know, posts and that stuff. So I get bombarded with emails every day. So they make it a lot easier for me to sift through the garbage.
Yeah, sure. But I mean, you know, I do a separate podcast where I interview just, you know, bands and stuff. And even just doing a 5-minute intro, you know, I'm just like, God, how do these dudes do it? But, you know, obviously you've got the years and years of experience of being on stage by yourself with just a microphone. I'm sure that plays into you being able to take an idea from an email and just riff on that for 55, 60 minutes.
And the years and years of experience as a comic channeling the frustration, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're right. Probably being on stage by myself with a mic, yeah, definitely helps me do this.
And that's what your book, what your book's like, right? Your book, you always say that if you like your podcast, you'll like your book.
Yeah, it's pretty much like, yeah, it's the same flavor of my book. Just calling out, you know, social media, how people just are bragging, you know, looking for sympathy or attention, you know, and I have actual posts in there that I just kind of break down and just, you know, explain what they're really doing in this post. You know, like the woman that posts, you know, I'm on my way to the hospital, and that's it.
Right, yeah.
You know, so now you got 75 comments. Are you okay? Oh, my God. If I lived in Detroit near you, I'd be there for you. Please keep us posted.
Yeah, you poor thing.
You know, she just wants, hey, that's what everyone's going to write, prayers.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and then at the end, after an hour, it was just a sore throat, she writes.
Right, exactly. Or if they want people to really get concerned, it's a picture of an IV.
Oh, shit.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that, you know, oh, my God, well, you know, feeling a little better.
Turns out I drank too much last night.
Yeah, it's well, you know what it is? It's all about competition. Like, everybody is in competition because they see one of their friends getting all this attention on social media. So then they, you know, bothers them. It's almost like being back in high school. Like, in high school, you're always looking, you know, you're awkward, socially awkward. You're trying to meet new friends. You're not sure exactly how to do this. You want to fit in, you know. But now these people, like, in their middle age and their 30s, and they're still doing stuff they did in high school just looking for attention because somebody else got a little more.
I think social media is exactly what you're describing. It's high school all over again for 30, 40 something.
It's high school.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. Because it's like, hey, why did he get 17 likes on his plate of ravioli when I posted my meatballs last night? I only got 2 likes.
Yeah, that's not fair.
It's not fair. Like, what is wrong with this plate? Did I not do it? Are my friends mad at me? Like, now they go into a place like, are people mad at me? Is that why I only got 2 likes? And meanwhile, no one's mad at them. And they think they got all this stuff going on in their head. You know, and then the next day you say to your, she calls a friend calls, goes, hey, how you doing? Good. You know, I posted these, my dinner last night of meatballs on Facebook. Oh, really? Oh, you know what? I dropped my phone in the toilet. I was at the Apple store. You know, I didn't get a new phone till today. I didn't even see it. Oh, okay. Meanwhile, all night she was tossing and turning. Why is my best friend mad at me? She didn't like my meatballs.
We were talking before you came on. One of our favorite kind of like vibes that you have on your thing is when you sort of call out people for lying, and you do this really dramatic like, do you? Do they?
Well, oh yeah, what, lying on Facebook? Yeah,
right. Yeah. Well, it's a great way. As you're doing your podcast by yourself, to be able to, you know, you kind of mildly go into maybe a thicker New York accent when you're talking about someone at brunch. And, you know, and you're doing both characters, even though it's not far from your voice. And it's just great. You know, it's like, oh, are you?
Did you?
That's one of our favorite parts about your episodes.
Yeah, see, I think it's funnier if I really don't do characters, you know? Like, if I just kind of do the voice, like, I'm just like, it's half-hearted, you know, but you get the point, who's talking.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm not going to just play characters. I'm not going to be like a method actor or anything like that. I'm just going to kind of just riff.
We got fucking Daniel Day. We got Daniel Day Lewis over here.
I don't even know where I'm going with it.
Oh, man. Well, so let's get into that metal show. We've been big fans of that show. We have a sort of a yearly metal night that we do with some of our musician friends in town. One of those nights we dressed up like Dimebag Darrell. We attempted to drink Black Tooth Grins, and I don't even remember going to sleep that night. An amazing show. I'm sure many of our listeners are fans of it. It was on VH1 Classic from 2008 to 2015, 14 seasons, hosted by Eddie Truck, Don Jameson, and yourself. And, I mean, looking at the list of guests you guys had, Ace Frehley, Peter Criss, Geezer Butler, Bill Ward, Geddy Lee, Alex Lifeson, all the dudes from Pantera minus Dime, Duff and Slash, Rob Halford, Steve Vai, Mustaine and Ellefson. I mean, good God, you got to meet all of your metal heroes.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was, you know, every year, like, we're doing a new season, I'm like, I'd see the guest list, I'm like, oh man, this guy's on. Like, every year, I'd be like, I cannot believe I'm going to meet this guy. And then the next season, it'd be somebody else, And it was just, that was an amazing run. We had a great run with it. And, you know, when you do TV, you know, like, basically when you get a TV show, it's like being a football coach. You get the job. You know, eventually, everyone loves it. Oh, my God, it's going to be... And you eventually know you're going to get fired. You know what I mean? So just enjoy the ride, and eventually things are going to go sour in the beginning or wherever. You're doing pretty well, whatever. The coach is there 4, 5, 6 years, and they're like, he's burnt out. We've had enough. We're going to make some changes or whatever. So I've been on shows before, so I just... Every year we got picked up, we're doing another season. I'm like, oh, my, all right, awesome. Wow, okay.
Yeah.
Because they only let you know... Like, after the season, like, they'll let you know. They keep you in suspense all the time. So just that we lasted that long was amazing. For TV, that's, you know, 130 episodes is a lot.
Yeah, I mean, 14 seasons, that's a huge accomplishment. And, you know, I'm sure, like you said, you know, you just kind of go along for the ride and hope that it lasts and it's going to end one day. But, I mean, I'd imagine you guys didn't think, we'll take this 14 seasons. And when it... When it did end, do you think, was it because the network changed, or was it just time for the show to end?
No, it was a network thing. Our ratings were, like, better than ever. That's what the producer told us by the end.
They went to MTV Classic at that point, right, from VH1?
Yeah, they basically, well, what happened was Viacom, the company that owned the show, that owns Comedy Central, MTV, VH1, VH1 Classic, Nickelodeon, they were losing a ton of money. So they had to come in and you know, just overall, you know, a lot of it had to do with Nickelodeon, because Nickelodeon, they used to get a ton of money from there. And then all of a sudden the kids started watching, you know, shows on YouTube and on their iPad and stuff, and not going to Nickelodeon anymore. So right. That was a big cash cow for them. So Viacom's losing it. MTV hasn't had a hit since Jersey Shore, which was like 10 years ago. So, you know, everybody, so someone comes in, they're losing so much money. Someone comes in, you know, a new guy, and goes, okay, we need to make some cuts. We need to cut all this, you know, this fat off. And part of it was getting rid of the VH1 Classic channel, the whole channel altogether.
Man.
And our show, you know what I mean? Just say, let's just get rid of this. There's no reason for this channel, and we'll do this. So, you know, they basically got rid of the whole channel. So it wasn't necessarily anything to do with us. And that was the channel that we fit on. We wouldn't fit on regular VH1 when they're showing Basketball Wives, you know, and then we had to lead a Ford on after that, you know, after Shaniqua just pulls a, you know.
How did you get the gig? I mean, did you already know Eddie, and how did you get roped into it?
Yeah, me and Don have been friends for a long time. We used to come back from comedy shows, like in the new, Eddie has a radio show in New York on Friday nights from like 11 at night to 2 in the morning. And he just plays metal, whatever he wants to play. I've been listening to him for years, and Don was, and we'd be driving back from comedy shows on a Friday night, listening to him like, man, this guy likes the same music as us. How do we not know him? And we eventually met him at a concert. And we went up to him and said, hey, man, we're big fans of your show. We're comedians. He goes, oh. He goes, come on my show. He goes, I love comics to sit in. We'll talk metal. I'm like, all right. So we started going up there on a show on like Friday nights. And then he's like, I'm working at VH1 now. We had an interview show. He goes, I'm going to pitch a talk show, like a heavy metal talk show with us three. We're like, all right. And that's how it went down.
Wow.
So I only knew Eddie for about a year or two before we got the gig. Like, we just, I don't know how Amazing. We didn't know each other. We're all around the same age and we like the same music, but we never ran the same circle.
Well, was there sort of like a vetting process of like, all right, look, because Eddie is famously known as like Stump the Trunk. This motherfucker knows. He's an encyclopedia of metal. And you and the other cat are too. But was there like a vetting process of like, look, if we do this show, you motherfuckers better know what's up. Like, you know what I mean? Was it that kind of vibe?
He knew that we knew. You know, we go on his radio show and we sit there and do all this trivia and talk and all this stuff. He knew that we were real metal fans, and all the concerts we went to, we were at a lot of the same concerts when we were kids that we talked about. So he knew we knew.
So there was no question that Eddie was going to bring you guys into this. There was no audition process or anything like that. He just kind of was like, you guys are the guys?
Yeah, no, he just said, hey, I got these two other guys who sat in the meeting, want to do a heavy metal talk show, and they go, okay, we'll give you money for one episode, a pilot episode, and we'll see what it looks like. And we got Lita Ford to do it, and we shot the pilot, and the network's like, oh, we love this show. You guys are, you know, we're picking it up for like 8 episodes, whatever. And then by the time we didn't even shoot the first season of like 8 episodes when they said we want to do a second season.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
One of the heads at VH1 was a big metal head. He used to be a DJ, Tom Calderon. He's a great dude. He's the one who pretty much greenlit the show. And he was like a metal DJ up in Buffalo. And so he loved the show. He's like, oh man, I want this on the network.
So a great guy to have in your corner, basically.
Yeah, it was great because most of the people there didn't know the music at all. They had no clue.
So out of all the badass guests you guys had, I mean, the list is amazing. Was there anyone you guys really wanted to get but didn't get?
Probably Jimmy Page, Robert Plant, you know, the guys from Zeppelin.
Yeah.
That would have been amazing. I guess Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley. But, I know they had some kind of beef with Eddie, so they weren't going to come on the show. But I was never a huge Kiss fan. I liked them. I respected them. But I was never, so to me, it didn't matter. But I think Page and Plant, and Eddie Van Halen, or Alex. And Roth, David Lee Roth, would have been great, too.
Was it the case where you wanted them to come, and you maybe reached out, and they either declined or couldn't make it work with their schedules, or?
I don't know. You know, I know that Jimmy Page, they pitched it to Jimmy Page and his management. And I don't think it came from Page. Said, Jimmy's not coming on a show that's called That Metal Show. He's not heavy metal.
What?
I know I heard that. I heard that one. But it also depends if they're promoting anything. Like, if Page isn't promoting anything, which a lot of times he's not, why would he come on? You know what I mean? Like, why is he going to come to America to come on a show that's on basic cable, channel 336?
Yeah.
So that's why I look at it like that. And Robert Plant doesn't want to talk about Zeppelin all the time. You see his interviews, he gets a little annoyed.
Sure, right? Understandable. So,
you know, but those are the guys. And Eddie and the Van Halen brothers would have been amazing, too.
Well, so you had Kirk and Lars and Newstead, never any Hetfield. Is that right?
No, but James watched the show because we did this Orion Fest. They had a comedy stage, and me and Dom were on the comedy stage in Hetfield. And he would say to Eddie, too, he goes, I love the show. I love what you guys are doing. I watch every week, but that's not my scene. He goes, let Lars go on, let Kirk or whatever. You know, he goes, that's not me. He goes, but I love what you guys are doing, man.
Man, the episode where Kirk jams with Michael Schenker is absolutely amazing because you can see that Kirk is still such a huge fan. And I guess I assumed that those guys had probably already met and hung out, surely, because Schenker knows that Kirk always talks about UFO and what an influence it was. But that episode where it's like they meet for the first time almost and jam together, that is an amazing episode.
No, absolutely. It was unbelievable that Kirk, you know, he wanted to be in. You know, I guess Eddie reached out to Kirk when he said, hey, I got Michael Schenker coming. He's going to play guitar if you guys want to do a jam. And Kirk's like, I'm there. He couldn't believe it. Yeah. I guess they don't travel in the same circles, you know, Schenker and Kirk, you know?
Right.
So I don't know. I guess they never met before. But no, but that was an amazing moment on the show.
Well, and that was an extra special treat for you guys as hosts because, you know, every time I'd watch the show and there would be those jams or some guest musician playing, you know, in and out of commercial breaks, just the look on your guys' faces was so excited and joyful. Like, oh my gosh, like, not only are we interviewing this hero, but this guy's over here playing, the Alex Skolnick or whoever. And you guys always seem to be really excited, so you're getting a double dose of these musical icons, you know, on your show.
Absolutely. Now, that's the way we looked at it. We just couldn't believe it. Another time, I remember when Ted Nugent went off and started playing guitar. I just started riffing. I'm like, God, that's amazing.
We were talking on our episode last week about, you know, separating the art from the artist, and is there anything artists can do where it kind of bums you out to listen to their music? And one of our fans had written an email talking about Ted Nugent's sort of like right-wing political views. And it's like, dude, I don't care what that motherfucker believes. If Stranglehold comes on, I'm turning it up.
I see Nugent every time he comes around, like the last 5 years. He's amazing. I don't care. I'm a big Rage Against the Machine fan. I don't care about Tom Morello's politics. I'm a big Ted Nugent fan. I don't care about his politics.
Right.
I go to see the show.
Absolutely.
Right,
yeah.
It doesn't matter to me. Whatever they believe in, that's fine. I like someone with some passion, what one side or the other. I'm not a gun guy, but I respect Ted's passion for guns and talk about it. I don't own a gun. I don't like them. But I'm like, all right, cool. That's your thing. That's fine.
How do you feel about bow and arrows? You into them?
Maybe I might get into that one day. I don't know, maybe. But I don't care about any of that stuff. It's like whatever you're into, that's fine.
Either that, you know, or I mean? you're gonna have a podcast episode, going off about archery.
Archery, yeah. The archery episode.
No, I could see that. I don't know. I could see. You know, it's kind of like a I don't know. I probably wouldn't go off on something like that if that's what you want to do. You set up a bullseye in your backyard, you shoot darts. I'd rather play darts in a bar.
Agreed. Also known as tiny archery.
Yeah, small archery.
Yeah.
So were there any guests that were memorable in a way that they were difficult or hard to work with or disappointing in any way? I mean, we're not trying to talk shit, but was there anything that...
No.
Anything like that?
None of them. No. I mean, our show, you know, like, look, if Dokken's going to have a new album come out or whatever, you know, they're not going on a Tonight Show at this point, or most of those 80s bands. You know, Jimmy Fallon's not having them on, but our show will have you on as, like, you know, you'll be our first guest. Hmm. So I think they knew it's a bit, you know, and plus Eddie's known most of these guys for 30 years being in radio.
Right.
So he's got a personal relationship with them. So none of them are going to be dicks when they come on, and no one was.
Well, and they're all, you know, most, all of them, if not all of them, are saying yes to it. So it's like they're in agreement. They know what they're getting into. And they know it's a big platform for them as far as promoting a new record, a book, a DVD, whatever. And especially, like you said, if they're not getting asked to do the Tonight Show or Fallon or whatever, then this is a great
spot. And they're older now, too. They're older, not in their 20s where they might have been dicks. You know, you realize it's a business.
Right.
You know, and most metal guys are really, like, cool dudes. You know, over the years, I've met most of them, you know, are just, you know, cool dudes just to begin with. They've always been. And, you know, if you're a metalhead, they're a metalhead. And it's just like this little community. So they, you know, not really dicks.
Other than Ethan, I totally agree with that. You guys right. did a segment. about bands that should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And it was just so crazy to see that when you guys would do that. And since the show's been off air, many of those bands have been inducted, Kiss and et cetera. Do you think that the show moved the needle on any of those bands finally getting inducted?
No. I think that I think the reason they're getting inducted is because they're running out of bands to induct. You know, how many times, Rod Stewart put a solo album out in 1971 and they inducted that band. They're running out of those things.
Right, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, Bruce Springsteen did a side project, with his friend, and that's it. You know what I mean? So they're running out. Like, oh, we got to start putting some more bands in because we got nothing. So I think that's the case. That's what's going on.
Right.
Well, and you're going to get to the point sometime in, the next 20, 30 years where all of a sudden we're inducting Justin Bieber and things like that. And there's going to be no bands to induct.
Oh, Jesus.
No, there won't be. Absolutely. I mean, I think Ozzy's solo should be in. Ozzy's solo career should be in.
Is it not?
No.
Wow.
No. I mean, Black Sabbath, it took 9 years for Black Sabbath to get in.
Dude, I know, Jimmy, you said you're not a big Kiss guy. I'm a pretty big Kiss fan. It took them 20 years.
Well, Kiss, but you got to realize Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is all coming from like Rolling Stone magazine.
Right.
And Rolling Stone never had any heavy metal in their magazine growing up. If you were a metalhead, you never read Rolling Stone. You're like, I'm not reading this garbage. Radiohead was on a cover every other week.
Right.
So it's like for metalheads, we went to like Hit Parade or a circus or
a
Kerrang or something like that to get the metal news. So, they never respected those bands. So, of course, and they thought probably Kiss is a joke band wearing makeup. Being silly, so they weren't going to take him serious until they had no choice.
It is a bummer that Eddie kind of got a little sideways with Paul and Gene. From what I understand about that drama is that Eddie, like many OG Kiss fans, is critical of the fact that Eric Singer and Tommy Thayer are wearing the makeup. And Paul and Gene take this, they take a hard line on that. They don't like being criticized for that, And Eddie's kind of just really speaking for a lot of original gangster Kiss fans. I personally don't care as much, but it would have been nice to have seen Paul and Gene on that show. I think that would have been a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know the history with them. I mean, I know they were friends for a while, but then they're not. And so, yeah. I mean, I think that's the case. They don't, they don't like to be criticized on stuff like that. But, it's fair. Same with when Sabbath toured without Bill Ward. It was fair to people go, I'm not going to go because Bill Ward's not behind a drum set.
Right.
So I get it. I went. I saw it every time. And I loved it. I wish Bill was there, but I'm like, I'm still going.
I loved your interview with Bill Ward on the show. Were you guys nervous? Like, do you ever get nervous to talk to these people?
No, not really. I mean, I don't get nervous. I just, you throw a question out there. Look, I know if I'm going to ask a question being a dick, then I would get nervous. Like, I don't want to, upset this guy or he's going to get mad. But most of my questions weren't about that.
I could see you doing the "did you" voice to Bill Ward. He's like, "Oh yeah," and then we recorded "Paranoid." Did you? Did you record "Paranoid"?
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure Bill Ward would dig that.
I'm sure he'd love that brand of comedy. So, can we talk about the infamous Axl interview?
Yeah, no, Axl. I guess they were doing a U.S. tour, Axl's version of Guns N' Roses at the time, and his manager said, "Look, Axl wants to promote the tour. They just put it on sale, and if you guys come down to Miami, fly down to Miami and interview him backstage, he'll be on the show. You guys can film it too and put the concert on VH1 Classic, and Axl will give you guys an interview backstage. But you guys have to come here. We're not coming, Axl's not coming to New York." So we said, "All right, we'll go." Absolutely.
Yeah,
it was
no
the first
shit.
Interview in like 15, 20 years on TV.
A big deal.
But what happened was supposedly his management at the time didn't tell Axl that we wanted to interview him.
Oops.
He just said, "Hey, VH1's going to, film this and then we're going to promote it. And stuff. They'll put it on VH1. They'll see the band, how good you guys are. And people will come out to the show." And Axl's like, "All right, that's fine." He goes, "He's going to interview some guys in the band backstage." Axl's like, "All right, whatever." And then the manager said, "I'm not going to hit Axl with this like a month before. I'd rather VH1 come all down here with their crew, film it, and then I'll hit them up like the day of the show."
Rolling the dice.
"Axl, they want to interview you too."
Wow.
That's bold for his manager to wait till the day of the show.
No, I know. But he's like, "Screw VH1. I don't give a shit. Let him come down here. Let him film it. Let him get interviews with the other guys in the band. And then I'll ask Axl the day of, do you want to do the interview? If not, at least they filmed it and they're going to show it on VH1. And then again, I'll just blame it on Axl or something, whatever. And so Axl didn't know that the day of, because they're here to interview me. He's like, "Well, it's part of the whole package." And he's like, well, if I'm going to do it, I'll do it after the show. I don't want to do it before the show. He goes into his whole routine. And so we just did it at like 4 or 5 in the morning. They didn't get off stage till like 3 in the morning. They went on at midnight and got off at 3 a.m. They played a 3-hour show.
Wow.
And we interviewed them about 5 a.m., which is no big deal. Like, everyone's like, oh, man, you guys must have been tired. I'm like, you know how many times I've walked out of a strip club at 7 a.m. and walked right on a plane and been up all night? Oh, I'm so, feel bad for me that it was 5 a.m. and I was interviewing Axl Rose backstage in Miami.
You're actually conducting this interview from a strip club right now at 11 in the morning, I believe.
Yeah, exactly. But seriously, so no, but it was great. But Axl, you know, so he pretty much got it. Didn't matter. I don't care if we interviewed him at 2 in the afternoon or 6 in the morning. It doesn't matter. We interviewed him, you know, so to me, at the time, everyone's like, oh, man, he made you guys wait. He didn't make us wait. He had no idea until the day of. And he's like, if I'm going to do it, I'm doing it after the show.
I think maybe the editing of the show kind of made it come across that way, that it was an annoyance. Maybe you were waiting, you know, till 4 a.m.
Yeah, they kind of played it up, maybe, the editors.
Probably. But seriously, they didn't get off stage till 3 o'clock in the morning. Okay, yeah. So when you get off at 3, you know, I mean, by the time you shower and just unwind after a 3-hour show, I mean, that's a long show.
I think that's a great example of, I think a lot of what has been relegated to like Axl being dramatic or whatever, a prima donna for much of his career, has been kind of misunderstandings like that. Like where he refuses to go on because they're playing in like Brazil and the security isn't up to snuff and he doesn't want to go out on the deck and put his crew in danger. Like the dude's definitely an interesting cat, but it's like if you kind of dig beneath a lot of this stuff, or him refusing to go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, he wrote this open letter. I don't know if you read that, Jim, but he wrote this letter about why he wasn't going to go, and it was actually really well written and well argued, and I think he's been kind of misunderstood a lot. It's easier to just say he's insane or something, you know?
No, totally. Look, back in the day when he was younger, yeah, he made it to crowd and stuff like that, whatever he was going through at the time as a 25, 27-year-old guy. Okay, fine, but he's definitely cleaned up his act. And as far as the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the only reason they inducted Guns N' Roses is they wanted Axl to show up, and right. He wasn't. He didn't make amends with those guys with Duff and Slash at that time. So he's like, no, I'm not showing up just so you guys can get an exclusive of us playing together.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I know what you guys. Axl saw right through that. That's exactly what they wanted to do.
Yeah, smart. I mean, he's a smart dude. He knows what he wants. He's always done what he wanted to. And if that meant not showing up to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, then he's not going to be there.
Yeah, and because he wasn't, you know, if they were friends and stuff, and they were, you know, they had put their differences aside, even though they still weren't playing together, then maybe he would have been there. But the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame did that, so those guys would get together, and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame would get the exclusive on it. And Axl's like, nope, I'm sorry, that's not happening.
And as a huge lifelong Guns fan, I remember at the time really getting it and kind of supporting Axl in that. I saw the 2012 sort of reiteration of Guns N' Roses. I thought it was a great show. They came out on time. They played super fucking long. It's weird to think about now, imagining then that they would still be on this Not In This Lifetime tour, one of the highest grossing tours of all time, with Duff and Slash and Axl together. They've sort of figured it out. And I do miss Izzy, though. I wish Izzy was in the fold with this tour they're doing.
Yeah, well, Izzy's always been a wild card. You know, he shows up, he doesn't, he's a drifter. Mostly drives around in like an RV and just, you know, hops around and, you know, we can find them and stuff like that. So I don't know, maybe the money wasn't right. Who knows? Supposedly it came out that maybe it wasn't. Izzy's like, they didn't offer me enough. But I heard a story that Izzy showed up at a sound check somewhere and was going to go out and perform. And then he left before the show even started.
Damn.
Yeah. I guess they could always carry around the Where's Izzy sign, because that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, just wearing the Where's Izzy shirt forever.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. You know, look, you never know what's going on with that stuff. And, you know, people feel slighted and I should get this much money and this. It's like, I don't know. But I mean, the Reunited Guns with Slash and Duff is amazing. I saw the show 4 times. I saw it the first night. Well, I saw the first night in Vegas after the club show in L.A. when Axl was in the Throne.
They played the Troubadour, right, in L.A.?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Troubadour, yeah.
Well, we got to see in Nashville, Steven Adler actually came out and played a few songs with him. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, yeah. He only did that at a couple shows. I think like Cincinnati, Nashville, maybe one in South America, and then L.A. But I heard about it happening 2 nights before in Cincinnati, and looking at my buddy I was with, like, God, if Steven Adler's here, that'd be amazing. And sure enough, they brought him out, and he was great.
Jim, are you a Steven Adler? Are you a Steven Adler or a Matt Sorum guy, or do you even play that game?
Steve Adler.
Right.
Yeah.
They're two different drummers. I mean, yeah. You know, look, Storm's great too, but they were definitely two different drummers, but I was more of an Adler guy.
Right. I think most people fall into that. I'm such a big Use Your Illusions fan that I've always kind of been a Storm dude.
Yeah, the great records. They're just, you know, like I said, it's almost like, you know, Dio against Ozzy and, you know, Hagar against, you know, Roth. You know, it's just two different people.
Or Gary Cherone.
Yeah, Gary Cherone. Come on. Don't forget Van Halen 3.
Right. I'm a Cherone cat over here.
That's true. Or you're Vinnie Vincent or Bruce Kulick or, yeah.
Yeah.
The list goes on. So let's talk about Metallica a little bit. So I actually didn't know this. We do this thing called a Patreon, and we have people who support the show financially. We let them ask questions to some of our guests. So we have some questions for you later. But one of the questions that I wanted to jump to is, during the early Johnny Z days of Metallica, the boys make their first trip out to the East Coast. They get signed to his label. They're going to make Kill 'Em All. You actually brushed up against the band at that time. You knew Johnny Z, is that correct?
Yeah, Johnny Z. I grew up in Old Bridge, New Jersey. Johnny was in Old Bridge, and he started, you know, Megaforce. He had a little a shop at a flea market that he, you know, a record store at a flea market that would be up, like, you know, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So every Friday, we'd go there with our paychecks, me and my friends, and pick up whatever records. He'd have all these import records, and he'd play. We hang out in the store all night, basically. And he'd play, you know, these new bands, Raven and Saxon and Motorhead and all this stuff. And then he had this No Life to Leather cassette. He goes, "See this band?" He goes, "I'm going to manage this band. This band's going to be huge." And wow. he had the cassette, and he started playing the cassette. He goes, "I'm bringing them to the East Coast. I'm signing them. They're going to do a bunch of shows. They're going to book them in all these places." So next thing I know, Metallica's here, you know, staying at Old Bridge in the town I live in, and they're staying at Johnny Z's house. And I guess they just had a kid at the time, Johnny and his wife. And they were just, you know, all four of them just in the house, drunk, you know, and stuff. And Johnny would call up and goes, "Hey, man, can you get these guys out of my house, man? Can you take them out? I need some peace with my wife and my kid. I got an infant here." So I picked those guys up in my mom's car. I was 16 or 17 at the time.
Holy shit.
Wow.
Mustaine was still in the band.
Yeah, wow.
Oh, so you were picking him up before they sent him back home. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So I picked him up and I drove him to the mall. I walked around with him in the mall. Then we went back to the flea market. You know what I mean? Just drive him around town, just get him out of the house.
I like the idea of you. I like the idea of you taking him to the mall. They wanted to go to Fashionable Male and and get a new suit.
No, they just wanted to get out and just walk around. You know what I mean? So I just I didn't know what to do. What do I know? I'm like, there's a mall over here, and they're like, okay. And, you know, and I just walk around with them and stuff, and then take them to the flea market, and they'd just be checking out stuff, whatever. Just killing time.
Just keeping them occupied.
And then, keep them occupied. And then, you know, Johnny Z had them playing all these shows. Like, they played at a roller rink. They did a show there. And they would do shows all over. They opened for Twisted Sister at this place called the Found Casino, you know. So they were doing shows, and they were just hanging out. Like, I was only 17 at the time. They were hanging out like strip clubs and bars, and I can get in some bars, but not all of them. So they were always just around in that Old Bridge area, you know, in the town I was in. I'd see them around town all the time, just hanging and stuff. But I was there in the beginning. I mean, they didn't remember that when I told Lars. He's like, "Oh, that's cool." I mean, I didn't expect them to remember. Like, "You don't remember?" He's like, "No, how would I?"
But, remember the mall? Come on, though.
Yeah, you don't remember the mall? We went to the mall. It was awesome. So,
yeah, like, you don't remember?
We had an Orange Julius. It was great, guys.
Yeah, we went to the cookie stand in the food court. So I think one of the things that's most fascinating, a window into that world, is that's obviously pre-fame Metallica. Not a lot's kind of known about those days, at least interpersonally. And a lot of people are curious about, you know, what was the band interaction like? Did they come off as friends? And people definitely are curious about, like, what was Cliff like? And did you have any one-on-one interactions with Cliff? And is there any insight into that stuff that you remember?
I don't really remember, you know. I just remember they all seemed to get along. They all hung out together, you know. They were all, you know, going to the bars together and this and that. And, you know, when I see them, you know, hanging out at the store or whatever, and, you know, backstage, because, you know, they do these little shows. Like, Johnny Z would find some bar. He'd go, "Oh, Metallica's going to play here, and Man of War's going to open for him." Like, okay, oh, wow, okay, cool, you know. So we just, I don't remember. I didn't see any tension. I didn't see any of that stuff. So I'm not sure. But then, you know, I was, like I said, I was a little younger. So the Old Bridge Metal Militia guys, Rock and Ray and Metal Joe, they were like 4 or 5 years older than me. So they had a house. So then they started staying at their house. So they know more about that history.
Right.
Than me. They were there with doing parties all the time. I didn't really know those guys, and they weren't going to let like a 17-year-old punk kid come over. You know, they were older than me, so I didn't really know them at that time. But I know that Ray told me, I'm friends with those guys now, and Ray was telling me that just like 4 or 5 years ago, he was trying to sell his house, the same house that he grew up in, that Vitalik used to stay at. And it was on the market for like 2 years, and he couldn't get rid of it. And some guy came on like a Sunday, like an open house, and he started talking to him. And the guy goes, wait, are you rocking Ray? He goes, yeah. He goes, oh, man, you're part of the Old Bridge Metal Bush. He goes, you know Vitalik? He goes, of course. He's like, oh, man, I'm such a huge Metallica. But he goes, really? He goes, Metallica used to stay here. And the guy was freaking out. He goes, you see that bathroom right there, that toilet? James puked in that toilet. He goes, James puked in that toilet. He goes, yeah. And the guy bought the house because he heard that James puked in the toilet.
Amazing.
Holy shit.
Yeah, because I sold my house. That's what sold my house. And I told him that James puked in that toilet.
Well, you should be a heavy metal realtor and just find historic houses that bands threw up in to sell them old metal heads.
Oh, my
gosh. I know. Yeah.
So were you going to a lot of these shows that Johnny Z put on, like at these little clubs that you could get into? Were you trying to go to whichever ones you could, or just whenever you heard about it?
Everyone possible. I had a fake ID. You know, back then you didn't have to have a picture on the ID in New Jersey. So I had my brother's ID that said I was 20 when I was really 15. So it was 5 years older than me.
Yeah.
Some of the places I could get in, but most of them I did. So, yeah, but they were always all ages shows usually, or they had like a wristband or something. But we'd always get in. Like, they didn't care about back then. You know, bouncing, just like, all right, whatever. You were 16. They knew you were 16, 17.
Right.
They didn't care. They just looked the other way. They just wanted people in the place. So, but yeah, so we, you know, so I saw a ton of shows. I mean, they brought Raven over, Anvil, Riot, you know, Man of War, Metallica. So all these bands, you know, Accept came over and was doing some shit. It was amazing.
Were you tight with the Anthrax cats too through Johnny Z?
I didn't know them that well because they did some shows because they were more based in New York.
Right.
You know, you're all, you know, so I knew those guys later on, but I didn't know. I'm more to like the Raven guys because Raven and Metallica did that All for One, One for All tour.
Right. The Kill 'Em All for One?
Kill 'Em All for One. Yeah, whatever. Yeah.
Right. So you obviously liked the music and you were a fan and you got to sort of be an interesting part of the beginning of that stuff. When they started to take off, were you just sort of a normal fan, got Ride the Lightning, got Puppets, all this stuff? Did you keep up with Johnny Z or through the change to Electric?
Yeah.
Electro?
Yeah, I did. You know, I was still around and, you know, and I was one of those guys that wasn't, you know, angry that they got big, that I saw them at a little club, which a lot of people do, which I don't understand. You know, I remember when they used to play in front of 20 people, you know, when they were, I saw them over Verazzi on the Master Puppets tour. I'm like, this is awesome, man. I love to see how big they got.
Yeah. I mean, and they, obviously they, you know, deserved all that early success, that the first wave of getting really popular after Kill 'Em All and Ride the Lightning and the Puppets and stuff. And I'm younger, so, you know, the early 90s was my kind of time, equivalent to what you had maybe with Metallica, where, you know, I was seeing, you know, some of those Southern California punk rock bands where I grew up and then see them get popular. And I never considered it, oh, you're selling out, this and that. You know, my band is gone, this and that. I was stoked for their success, you know, as you were for Metallica. And, you know, and even seeing Metallica through the Black Album, you know, that getting gigantic. I mean, for me, that was, I was proud of those guys.
Yeah, you know? Jim, where do you stand on the Black Album? What do you think about the change in the music, the success? Were you a fan of that record? Did you go see that tour?
I saw the tour. I had no problem with it. It was the time. MTV started playing videos. And Metallica, like, why not? You know what I mean? Like, they were still heavy songs. They were still great songs.
Absolutely.
To me. So I didn't have a problem with it at all. I mean, most people did. Like, oh, my God, they sold out. You know, you got to realize Metallica never got played on the radio until Injustice for All and the song One. And they would play it once in a while, like right. Late at night. But before that, they never played anything off of Master of Puppets, nothing off of any of the albums ever. Nothing, just so One, and they made the One video for it. And people are like bitching about that. But they, and then once the Black Album came out, it was so funny because they started playing, you know, the newer stuff. And then they went back and all of a sudden they were playing all the old Metallica stuff they never played before on the radio. It was always mandatory Metallica every 9 o'clock every night on every rock station.
Oh, yeah.
Then they started playing Master Puppets and Sanitarium and all that stuff. It was amazing how they went in their back catalog and then all of a sudden it was okay to play Metallica.
Right. Obviously, Jim likes the Black Album if you give Saint Anger a 7.5.
Yeah, no shit. God, the Black Album must be a 15.
I didn't look. Yeah, it was a commercial album. Yeah, but there's there's always bands that, you know, might put a more commercial leaning album out, you know? And I, you know, whatever you want it. Metallica always done like, you know, tried to do like a different album each time, which I respect. You know,
oh, yeah.
Black Sabbath was famous for that. Sabbath is my favorite band of all time. If you listen to their albums, you're like, well, all of them sound different.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of bands in existence that can keep doing the same thing on every single record and maintain any kind of success or popularity, with the exception of maybe AC/DC.
Yeah, I mean, Slayer, Motorhead, AC/DC are the three bands that come to mind.
Yeah.
But even though in those catalogs, there's been some clunkers in there.
Sure,
you're
yeah.
Like, ah. You know, Metallica, to me, hasn't put one out yet.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, even you know, Hardwired is, you know, yeah, there's everything on there. There's thrashy stuff. There's stuff that sounds like the Black Album. I've always described it as a best of sonically Metallica. You know, it's a good variety of what they've always done, but it's still something different.
Yeah, what do you think about Hardwired, Jim?
I love it. I think Death Magnetic's better, but I love it.
You know, we've often discussed Death Magnetic on our show a lot because we feel like that is a bit underappreciated just because of the production side of things. Me and Clint personally love that record. I was beyond excited when that record came out, you know, because I was, you know, like a lot of people, disappointed in Saint Anger. And so hearing Death Magnetic, I was like, God, the boys are back.
Well,
you know?
After Saint Anger, I wasn't sure if they would ever, I wasn't sure if that was going to be the new Metallica and that was going to be the deal. So to get the thrash sort of masterpiece level of Death Magnetic was like, oh, they're back, you know. I felt like that's how I felt about it.
That album is so good. A lot of people didn't give that. I remember playing that for a lot of Metallica fans, like, I don't know, could you hear Death Magnetic? Now I go listen to this and I play it, I'm like, wow, I gotta go get this.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
People didn't even give it a chance.
What's your favorite song on Death Magnetic?
Ooh, that's tough, man. There's not a bad song on that record.
Yeah, I agree.
True.
There really isn't, you know, from and that's why I think, like, because Hardwired, I'm not crazy, I forget the title of the song, it's the Motorhead tribute song.
Murder
I'm not
One.
Crazy about that one.
Yeah, that Murder One, yeah, that's the only one really that I might skip, but it's still not a terrible song by any means.
Right, exactly, but that's the one. So to me, Death Magnetic, you know, The Unforgiven 3 is pretty good, but there's no like songs I'm like, I could skip over that one.
Right.
And I don't mind the sound on it. Like, I don't know, I listen to that thing on my car, on my headphones, and you know what I mean, like, I'm not an engineer. I've been to 50 Motorhead shows, so my hearing is definitely not there. I'm not an engineer. To me, it sounds great. I like it loud, whatever.
Sure, yeah.
You know what I mean, that's for like, you know, people that are in the audio, listen to this, it peaks in the red. I'm like, who cares? That's what I want it to. I want it to peak in the red. You listen to Metallica, you want it in the red.
That's true, very true.
I want it to peak in the red.
I mean, to me, like, you know, I mean, when people get technical about the production issues of that record, I understand them, but at the same time, to me, those quote-unquote flaws, to me, made it sound like more old school. You know, it made it sound like an earlier recording by them.
Well, and how about the people who want them to go like re-record it? I'm like, that's what you want the boys to do, to spend their fucking time doing, is re-recording Death Magnetic or Saint Anger? Ugh, no thanks. The records are fine.
There's no reason to do that. Metallica's not a band that looks back.
No, never.
Right. So did you go see the last tour that they did last year? The stadium tour?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I saw it at MetLife Stadium in Jersey. It was amazing.
Awesome. It's such a great show, and cool to see. I mean, these dudes all in their 50s still just wearing it out for 2+ hours straight. And, you know, production was great. The boys sounded good. Me and Clint saw the Detroit show together, and then separately he saw St. Louis and I saw Philly. But, man, I can't wait for him to come back through again.
Yeah, because, you know, one thing about Metallica is they'll change the set list. They'll put some obscure songs in there, which is good. So I'm curious to see what their set list is going to be this time. And I'll definitely see them again.
Yeah. What are some, like, off the top of your head, what are some of the more obscure ones you'd like to see them do?
Well, I would love them to go back and play off of Death Magnetic, but they probably won't.
Yeah, they're not doing a lot of Death Magnetic, unfortunately.
No, that's one good thing about Metallica. I like what they do. When they announce a tour, Maiden does the same thing. They'll play like 5 new songs off the new record, which I always want to hear the new stuff because I've heard the old stuff a million times.
I agree.
So, like, when Sabbath released the 13 record, they played like 4 or 5 new songs. I was so happy because I've heard Paranoid, Iron Man, Children of the Grave a million times. So, to me, those songs were fresh and they were good songs. So, when Metallica did like 5 new songs off of Hardwired. I was like, yes. And they did it on the Death Magnetic tour. But then when they came back around the second time, they didn't do any of those songs.
Well, I know on the just this most recent European tour, they've had a couple rotating slots in the set list, and every once in a while they will throw in something off Death Magnetic. Usually it's only been the day
that never comes.
Yeah, the day that never comes. But hopefully we'll get... I would love
to... Broken, Beaten, Scarred. Broken, Beaten, Scarred, I would love to hear.
Oh, absolutely.
I would love if we went to a show in the fall or early next year and they did End of the Line.
Oh, the End of the Line. God damn it. That was just your life. Cyanide, All Nightmare Long.
That'd be great. I'd love to hear Frantic. Off of St. Anger.
You know what? I would too, honestly. Yeah. And that's,
I love that song.
That's my least favorite Metallica record, but I would love to hear Frantic or Dirty Window.
Yeah, Dirty Window's a ripper.
Dirty Window's amazing. I mean, the song St. Anger's a great song too.
Yeah, I agree. So are you hoping to get to some of these shows they just announced on the next leg of the North American tour?
Yeah, he said he was going to go.
Yeah, they're not playing in the Jersey area, but they're close enough. They're like a few hours away, and I'll definitely go see one. They'll probably come back and play Madison Square Garden a couple nights too.
Yeah, that'd be cool. We're trying to we're fortunate where we live in Nashville. It's pretty centrally located in the southeast, so I think we're planning on driving to a couple shows that are only a few hours away. But I think we're if our schedule, because me and Clint are touring musicians, we're hoping that we can get up to the Albany show.
Jim, when we go to the Albany show, we're planning on throwing a big party the night before. We've thrown a party in Nashville, sort of a party for the podcast, but mostly for Metallica. And you should come do a set. You should come do some stand-up and hang with us.
If you guys let me know about that, I might be going. Maybe that Albany show is definitely possible. I think that's the closest one.
Yeah, it's Albany, like Albany, and it's Albany and Buffalo.
Right, and then Penn State, I know, that's pretty far. So I think Albany is probably the closest show to doing to me.
Right.
Yeah.
So maybe I will. No, hit me up before that. Maybe we'll do that.
Yeah, for sure.
And because I'm such a big Load era cat, I got to hear, what are your thoughts on Load and Reload? Do you like those records?
I like them. I think it should have been one record together. Right. I thought it would have been a great record if they would have just combined all the songs, the best songs.
Yeah.
But, you know, bands get like that, you know, they're like, hey, we wrote so many great songs that we can't, you know, we have to put them all out, which I think, you know, it's better off just recording those songs and putting on something later in your career, you know, some extra songs. You put a box set out, here's 4 songs that didn't make the Load, you know, record. I always like when bands do that instead of just throwing them all on a record.
I think they saw what happened. I think they saw what happened with Use Your Illusion 1 and 2, and I think they wanted to kind of go for that kind of thing.
Yeah, but even with those 2 records, there's a couple on there that, there's more on Use Your Illusion 1 and 2. I think those 2 are better records than Load and Reload.
Right. I would agree with that, actually.
Load, there's some great songs on both records, which, if that was combined, but then again, that was at the point where they cut their hair, so, and they, you know, and all these Metallica fans are like, oh, they cut their hair, you know, because all their fans still had long hair, and they got mad, like, you know, like, oh, they cut their... I'm like, why? So they're not good anymore because they cut their hair?
Doesn't that sound so ridiculous looking back on that? Oh, you cut your hair. Even Alice in Chains was pissed at them.
No, I know. They really, there were so many Metallica fans that took a person that they cut their hair. They're like, they cut their hair. I'm not listening to them anymore. I'm like, what does that have to do with anything? I go, you're going to cut your hair when you have to go to court one day.
Yeah.
That's when a long haired guy cuts his hair, when he has to go to court.
Yeah,
or
exactly.
He gets married and he has a wife that doesn't like it anymore.
Exactly.
Well, speaking of fans getting kind of butthurt about it, you said you almost got into a fist fight over St. Anger. Break that interaction down for us. How did it escalate to...
I had a friend that was a Metallica fan, and we were drinking and we were listening to Ben. It was when St. Anger came out. I'm like, no, I'm telling you, give it a chance. It sucks. It's a... That drum, the snare drum, and the songs suck, and there's no solos. I'm like, just listen to stuff. And I put it on. He's like, it's terrible. I mean, you can't tell me this song, Frantic or St. Anger, is terrible. Listen to it. And he's just going back and forth, and we just, you know, we were at the point where, like, a friend had to break it up.
I love the passion.
He's like, I'm sorry. I go, you just read it. I go, you already had this negative thing in your head because there was no solos on it, that you were going to hate this record. It was the same thing with, Chinese Democracy. Everyone was going to go, it's not going to be Appetite for Destruction. So everybody hated that record before it even came out. And that's the same thing with St. Anger. Like, oh, there's no solos that Kirk doesn't play. You know, so I'm going to hand Lars a snare. And that was it. That's all anyone heard. And they didn't want to give that record a chance.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that was still, for me, back in a time when, you know, I didn't. There was no iPhone. I think the iPod may have been out for a year or something. I didn't really have any digital music at that point, so I heard St. Anger the day I picked it up in the store, you know.
Right.
And, you know, it I was shocked and surprised, and I was like, whoa, what happened, you know? And it took me a while, you know, and even doing this podcast where we're diving in deep with Metallica shit, when we did our Saint Anger episode, you know, I spent 2 weeks straight listening to nothing but that. And, you know, after all these years, it was like, damn it, there's some gems on this thing.
With the last song on Saint Anger, I can't remember what it is.
All Within My Hands.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
That's a great song.
Yeah.
Yeah, the production's a little weird on it, but if you listen to the old Sabbath records, the production is different on every record, too. Yeah, now, obviously not like Muddy like that. Look, the one Sabbath record, Born Again, with Ian Gillan, listen to the production on that. That's all Muddy, but people love that record.
Well, you mentioned earlier the early Sabbath stuff, too. The jump from Black Sabbath to Paranoid, completely different production sounding, too. I mean...
And then Master Reality. Listen to Master Reality. It's a complete different sound. And then you got Volume 4, which is... And then, you know, Sabotage and Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath, they're all different. And Technical Ecstasy was completely different sounding.
Right.
I love when bands evolve, man. I mean, the Beatles did it in the 60s and early into the 70s. And if bands stay the same, I think I'd get bored, with the exception, like we said, of maybe AC/DC or the Ramones or something.
Look, Madonna did it.
Hey, if Madonna did it, then let Metallica do it.
Jim, what's your favorite Madonna record?
You know, she was an innovator back in the day. I'll give her credit. She definitely, had some good songs back in the day. But everybody copies her. You know, like you see the pop acts now. You're like, if you were around Madonna in a prime, you're like, Madonna did that 25 years ago.
Oh, it was something special and unique in the 80s for sure. I mean, my earliest memories of having a crush on a woman was the Borderline video. My sisters would watch it.
Oh, for me, it was Ray of Light.
Really,
that hit me at a pivotal time in my pubescent days.
There was a video. Was it Open Your Heart, where her tit pops out? Do you know that about that?
I didn't. I remember the video, but I don't remember that detail.
Yeah, she's wearing that black, and I think they're like in a peep show or whatever. But when she's, it pops out, and you had to record it on your VHS and then freeze frame it.
Well, I know what I'm going to do for the next several hours.
Clint goes to YouTube right now. Where are my Madonna VHSs?
So, Jim, we want to be sensitive to your time. Thanks so much for sitting with us. I've got a few questions from our patrons, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
All right. TJ, he doesn't even have a question. He says, I'm literally listening to his book right now. Crazy. That's all he had to say.
Oh, that's cool. Good.
Yeah.
The book called Everybody is Awful Except You. It's out now. You can check it out. Danny Santana asks... was there ever any guest from the show that you were trying to get but couldn't? Well, we answered that. Jimmy Page, Robert Plant, Eddie Van Halen.
Yeah.
David Bill, now this dude is a big fan because he's asking you stuff that I don't know about. He says, he got the house, which is a reference to your stand-up special, right?
Yeah, I got a stand-up special coming out. Yeah, this my tour is called I Got the House.
Okay.
Because of my divorce, I got the house. So I got that's named my tour.
That's a great title for a tour.
Yeah, isn't it great? I got a picture with the house on it with a gavel. Beautiful.
He says, what's Jim's plan to get Luke up there to play Lars's kit during the encore? I don't know. He says, what's Jim's plan to get Luke up there to play Lars's kit?
My son.
Okay.
My son, you know, he's 7 and he's been taking music lessons since he was 4. He's playing drums, he's singing, keyboard. He's learned like half of Mr. Crowley on keyboards already.
Awesome. Very cool.
So, I don't know. He'd love it. He's never seen Metallica. I think I'm going to take him to go see him in that fall run. That'd be amazing if he went up there and played on Lars's drum set.
He says, what are Jim's thoughts about Jim Breuer or comedians in general getting the opening slot for Metallica? He says, I think Jim has done that before for Slayer. He says, I hope it's a trend. I love it.
Well, he did it at the Orion Festival, too.
Right.
Yeah, I did it at Orion Fest, and also, yeah, went on tour with Slayer, Megadeth, and Anthrax. I think it's great. Jim Breuer is going to do amazing on that because, you know, he does all those impressions and stuff.
What do you,
and, you know,
do you prepare differently? I mean, are metal crowds, I mean, it's got to be a whole different ballgame. I mean, everyone loves comedy and stuff. I'm sure there's a massive crossover, but.
Yeah, well, with those shows, you know, you can't tell a story. You know, you
right.
can't go, is anybody here married? You know, like you got to get your jokes quick. You got to have set up punch, boom, boom, boom. Sex, drugs, those kind of jokes, some rock jokes about bands, and then, you know, make fun of hip hop. That's, you know, that was my set, basically.
Yeah.
You knew the place was going to go nuts.
Right, yeah. Well, Mixmaster Mike is over there spinning.
Oh, right, God.
Yeah, any kind of Kanye jokes are going to work in a Slayer show.
Yeah, I bet.
Okay, Nicole Williams asks, what did Jim think about Lars and Metallica coming after Napster? What did you think about the whole Napster debacle?
They were right. I mean, you look back at it, he did the right thing. He just got caught the brunt of it.
100%.
You know, like the artist got, everyone was just stealing music that went on for like 10 years. Now people are buying it again. They realize, all right, you know what, for $10, I'll buy, you know, on iTunes or whatever, or I'll get, you know, Apple Music and pay 10 a month to listen to that or whatever. So, no, someone had to put a stop to it. The artists were losing a lot of money. It wasn't so much about Metallica. It was more about, you know, the younger bands that weren't making any money. You know, because, you know, and the reason Lars didn't even know about that and that whole story is, you know, when they were doing that song for Mission Impossible, what is it?
I Disappear.
Yeah, I Disappear. You know, there was a version of it that got out there, like that got, you know, that wasn't done. And it was on Napster, and someone told Lars, like, what are you talking about? How'd that get out there? Like, I don't know, got from the studio, someone got it, and it's out there. And he goes, he's like, what is this Napster thing? And that's how he found out about it. He's like, this is bullshit. Which it was. And it's pretty, like, people aren't really stealing music as much anymore, which is great. You know, they finally figured out a way, or people will pay some, and Spotify and all this other stuff. So, you know, he took the bullet for that stuff. But, you know, most of the artists didn't want to talk about that. You know, Lars was like the guy who supports Donald, who says, I love Donald Trump. I think he's doing an amazing job. That guy takes a lot of fucking bullets, too.
Right, yeah. And Lars back then was really, you know, he was taking bullets for a lot of other artists that felt the same way, but didn't have maybe the clout to speak up or platform.
Yeah. I wasn't mad going, you know, fuck this guy. You know, I'm going to steal the music. You know what I mean? Like, I wasn't that guy. I was like, oh, yeah. I mean, he seems, I understand where he's coming from.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, yeah, we agree with all that. I think that time has proven that Lars was actually right about all that. Nicole also asks, when was the last time Jim saw or spoke to Newstead?
Probably about a year and a half ago. I did a Q&A with him. He was doing an in-store appearance, record store in Long Island. And I did, like, you know, did a Q&A with them for their album, when their album came out. Whenever it came out, it's the full length. He's a great dude, man. I like this. I like that stuff. The Newstead was great.
Yeah.
But I don't know. You know, I haven't heard from him since. You know, he kind of like just disappears for a while and then he just pops up. But he's a really nice guy.
He's kind of like the Izzy of Metallica.
Yeah, where's Jason?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have a preference in sort of the discography of the band? Do you have a preference for the Cliff era or the Jason era?
Usually the first era is always the best, especially when, you know, you got those first three records. So, you know, I'm more of the Cliff era, but Jason did a great job filling in for him. And that was a tough gig to do. You know, you never want to be that first guy taking over a legend.
Oh, absolutely. And we haven't gotten to this yet. Just real quick, what's your favorite Metallica record?
I you know, pound for pound, I hate to say it because it's probably,
Saint Anger.
What everyone says, a Master of Puppets.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat as you. Yeah, Clint's Ride the Lightning.
For me, it's Ride, but it's close. I mean, it's close. Puppets is damn near perfect.
Yeah, Master of Puppets is just a perfect masterpiece to me.
Agreed.
You know? So I got, you know, even though, you know, there's a lot, you know, yeah, Ride the Lightning's right up there. And to me, Death Magnetic's right up there, too, for me.
It's weird they changed. Sometimes Death Magnetic is like my favorite Metallica record. I just can't get enough of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's that strong. We've got two more questions. Chris Nace says, talking about the days when you were driving the band around to the mall and whatnot, he says, looking back, was there ever any indication that this group of dudes would be the ones who stood out from the rest?
No, I didn't see it. You know, I didn't see it because, you know, that music was kind of new at the time, the thrash. Like, I was, you know, I was buying, you know, well, Raven was kind of doing it too, but, like, I was into Ozzy and Black Sabbath and Judas Priest and Maiden and Motorhead, and then, you know, Metallica came out. It was like this thrash from San Francisco, which, you know, I didn't know anything about that scene as a little kid. You had no idea what was going on there. So I, you know, when I saw them open for Raven, open for Twisted Sister, and I was a huge Twisted Sister fan at the time, seeing them in clubs and stuff like that. So I didn't see it like, man, this band's going to be doing stadiums one day.
Yeah, I mean, I'd imagine, you know, it's tough to tell if any band's going to get to that point. You might have that gut feeling because of these songs or this and that. Obviously, you can't predict the future, but I mean, obviously, these dudes did it tenfold.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is, they can't, you know, that was the whole thing with Anvil. Like, Anvil, supposedly, like, that was a band that just never made it. Like, they were, everybody got influenced by them and thought they were, and they put, like, two great records out, but they just couldn't follow it up with more great records like Metallica did.
Right, yeah.
You know, Metallica was topping each other, Kill 'Em All, then they come out Ride of Lightning, like, holy shit. And then they come out with Master of Puppets, like, you gotta be kidding me.
Yeah.
And then, that, you know, the rest is history. So they, you know, they just kept proving that they just kept writing better records.
Yeah, man.
Astute points. I agree with all of that. Our last question for you from our good friend Jean Froman. She says, I'm curious to know what Jim's favorite Metallica concert's been. I know he did a set at Orion, and I remember seeing him at the Apollo show. Can't remember if he was at the Webster Hall show, but would be curious to know.
I was not at the Webster Hall show. I was at the Apollo show. I don't know. You know, the Apollo show was so amazing because they were only supposed to do like maybe 45 minutes to an hour, and they played 2.5.
Wow.
And it was amazing. But then the Orion shows, when they did the Black Album and they also did Ride the Lightning, you know,
holy
two nights
shit.
In a row.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable.
Was it, so you were, that. That was the Atlantic City one that you were at?
Yeah, the Atlantic City one. Yeah.
Okay. Very cool.
Yeah. And then, you know, Lars introduced me on stage at the comedy stage.
Oh, cool.
That's awesome.
Which was insane, yeah. And then him and James watched from, like, a golf cart on the side of the stage, watched my set. I was freaked out. I'm like, you know, oh, I can't believe these guys are watching me do comedy. It was freaking me out.
It seemed like all those dudes were, I mean, obviously it was the festival they organized, but they were heavily involved and excited about going to see all these other bands and excited about getting their fans into maybe something that wasn't heavy metal. You know, like, one of my favorite bands, Rocket from the Crypt, played the Detroit one. And James, turns out he's a big fan of it, and he was posting about it, and I'm like, this is so cool. These big, old-school metalheads are trying to get their fans into different things that aren't Metallica.
Who was the band in Detroit?
They were called Rocket from the Crypt.
Oh, I don't know them.
They're like they never got huge. They're like a punk rock Southern San Diego band, but a really, really cool, unique kind of punk rock band with horns.
Another band that they had kind of early on, the band that's kind of blown up a little bit, is that band Ghost. Are you familiar with Ghost?
Yeah,
band?
I know. No, James is a big fan. I know that they were on the Atlantic City show. It was weird because they played during the day, and the visuals were more like
right.
Night. But that was great. Yeah, they were. That was amazing.
Did you happen to catch the Iron Maiden tour last year that they opened on?
Yeah, I saw it in Vegas.
Wow, cool.
That's great, man.
Jim, thanks so much for your time, dude. We're going to kind of wrap it up here. We really appreciate you coming on the show. Again, the book's called Everybody's Awful Except You. You can get it on his website, jimflorentine.com, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Do you have tour dates coming up that you want to talk about? This episode will air next Monday.
Just go to my website, jimflorentine.com. All my tour dates there. I got my podcast comes out every Monday up on iTunes. And then, you know, yeah, my book's in stores or on Amazon.
Awesome, man. And if, yeah, we'll check out your tour dates too. And if you're coming through Nashville, man, I'd love to come see you.
Yeah, do you ever play Nashville?
Yeah, I've done
Zanies.
Zanies before. Hopefully, I'm going to be there soon. Hopefully, I love Nashville. It's one of my favorite towns. So, even if I don't do Zanies, I'll do like a rock club or something there. But I'll keep you guys posted.
Yeah,
yeah, please do, man. We loved it. We love to hang with you, grab a beer, and come see you perform. And yeah, we both live really close to all the rock clubs and Zanies and stuff. So,
perfect.
Well, once again, Jim, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Absolutely.
Well, there you go. That was awesome.
What a cool dude.
Yeah, so cool. And I mean, we know that Jim is a very busy guy, especially with, you know, tour dates coming up. He's got a new book out, all that stuff. So for him to take an hour and, you know, whatever, 10, 15 minutes out of his day to talk to little old us, we can't thank him enough. That was awesome. Thank you, Jim.
Yeah, it was cool. And we talked a little bit off the air when we got off the phone, and we're going to try to hang with him if he comes through Nashville. He's said he's willing to come to our party that we have before the show on the upcoming North American tour. And
if we can do it, we'll see. Hopefully we can.
So send us an email, send us your thoughts about the interview with Jim. Tell us what you liked and didn't like. Go follow him on all the socials too. Go check out his podcast, Comedy Metal Midgets. Super fucking funny. And is that it? Are we going to say goodbye?
I think this is short and sweet outro. I think we're just going to say goodbye.
All right, nerds. Peace.
Adios.
Our advisor, what would you say? Then I would say, delete that.